And 4 years ago, they all agreed to develop and put together something called the Statement of Commitment. That was designed to commit people to particular actions, the most important of which was creating a policy. The policies were then broken down a little bit within that statement, and of course the bit that's most relevant to today is that within that was a statement that said they would endeavour to ensure that mainstream tourism was going to be developed so that it benefited the local people and the local community and provided better access for the informal sector. So how do we go about that? A long multi-stakeholder process ensued around about 3 years ago in putting together a list of criteria, sustainability criteria, very broad, and we developed this handbook. About 63 different participants were involved in that multi-stakeholder process, representing all different areas of the sector, including the OECD Development Institute. And this is divided into four sections, one of which is devoted to people and the community and the way in which tourism endeavours to benefit them. Our role has been getting that handbook out into our supply chain and work to it as tour operators. And we're looking at the three different elements here: tour operators, suppliers and consumers. And just try to address all of those. Of course, the way in which we have tried to establish whether or not people are achieving this is to put in place a monitoring system. And this is quite advanced now in its development. So we have a method of self-checking and third-party checking to see how close, particularly our supply chain, are conforming to the criteria inside our handbook. In order to incentivise that, we created a system of awards so that that was linked to the performance that we were able to establish when suppliers were being checked. And our award system is now taking the form under this Travel Life branding, which we wind now to involve European neighbours as well. It's not just a UK initiative. And involves us having logos put into brochures rewarding suppliers who do particularly well, but they are meaningful. For example, you would not achieve any award in our system if you failed to satisfy certain mandatory criteria. And three of those that are particularly pertinent to what we've been discussing today is that you must have a policy in place that identifies how you integrate with the local community and how you benefit the community, that you have a member of staff responsible for those liaisons and relationships, and that you actively train those policies to people within the business. We've just come back from a Turkey roadshow, and during that we had an opportunity to tell all of our suppliers in Turkey that attended four different seminars about the criteria in our handbook and about the award system. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of interest, particularly that we've got some of those awards already in brochures for some other areas of the globe. But during the time that we were there, we had a chance to talk to individual suppliers, and we carried out third-party audits on those. And I thought it might be interesting just to give you a flavour of the types of things that we've identified that people are doing. When we asked the question in an audit-type approach about whether or not people were providing some benefit to the local community, the first answer was no, we're probably not. And therefore, we had to do quite a lot of seeking and searching, because people don't really realise how they carry out their business in the community. So what did we identify? Well, this is just from three hotels. We identified that there was a considerable amount of local purchasing. Our first one, 95% of its produce was actually from local producers, and he didn't go through an agent, he actually went direct to producer. He was inviting arts and crafts people, or had been, into the hotel, not charging them for space, not charging them anything whatsoever, but providing them space to actually showcase their products and sell them to the customers. We had a supplier who was inviting an orphanage to come and stay in the hotel out of season for a week on an all-inclusive basis, so assisting to providing them with some direct benefits. We had the same supplier opening up the hotel 3 days at the beginning and the end of the season to bring the retired community into the hotel for a similar sort of thing. Our third supplier actually paid for and built a school to train people in the locality in tourism skills, specifically in tourism skills, so that they could enter the sector. How am I doing for time?
1 minute.
1 minute, okay. part of the section on people deals with employers and employees, those relationships. And one of the things that we again identified out in Turkey particularly was that most suppliers there do have a lot of respect for their employees, and because it's a very transient business, if you're not really providing great benefits, they all seem to have developed this system where they provide accommodation for people free of charge, they provide transport for people free of charge working in the business, direct incentives that mean that people don't have to pay out from their monthly salary for items which otherwise would cost them dearly. So in fact, the income that they derive from working in tourism actually has greater value from working in other sectors. Finally, I'd just like to finish talking about consumers, because they're probably the most important part of this process. I'd just like us to remind ourselves here that without consumers, there wouldn't be an industry. They're the people that have the money. And therefore, what we really need to be looking at here is direct ways in which that money can go from the consumer direct to the poor without going through the middlemen. Because whenever you involve middlemen, then that means that the benefit is going to be somewhat reduced and potentially the amount that ends up in their hands. Okay? So I hope I've sort of given you a broad sweep of what we've been trying to do. But thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.
My name is Sue Myrtle. I'm from the Travel Foundation, and the Travel Foundation was set up as a partnership between the industry, the government, and the expert, what I call the experts, which includes many of the organisations in this room, NGOs, academic organisations, institutions, and think tanks, to try to bring together a lot of the really good work that was going on in the UK already to make outbound tourism from the UK more sustainable. And we are very practical in our focus. We've been doing work to look at the people and the environment, and also on educating the industry, so that in a nutshell, those are the three areas that we look at. Much of what we've been doing to date has been about piloting, demonstrating, and beginning to disseminate information about what can be done in a very practical sense, helping companies to train staff to understand if you're employed as an overseas rep in a destination, what can you do in your day-to-day life, if you like, to make your experience of tourism and that of your customers more sustainable. As far as the challenges of mainstreaming local tourism is concerned, Chris has talked about the great work that the FTO is doing in trying to simplify and give very practical advice through the Travel Life programme there. What the Foundation does, if you like, is to take some of that work and show in a practical sense how that can be done. So some of the work going on in hotels, for example, we've been working to showcase. You take a hotel through an audit of what can they do to improve their environmental and social performance, and then help them to actually put into practice new methods, new methodologies. UK industry has obviously set up to work with its suppliers, but then who works with the suppliers of the suppliers? So the farmers, for example, who are supplying the hotels. And that's another area where the Travel Foundation has been involved. I'll go on to tell you about that in just a moment. But I think as well as what we're doing, there's a real role for the sorts of organisations in this room to act as intermediaries, if you like, between the farmers and the craft producers and the tourism industry. Because often that intermediary role is what's needed. You know, we've been working with farmers who haven't been able to talk to the hoteliers in a language that the hoteliers understand. And the hoteliers haven't been able to trust that the farmers would be able to supply in the right quantity and quality and price. And by having an intermediary to build confidence on both sides, we've been able to set up a number of programs to help farmers to supply the hotel industry. So I think there's a role here for organisations out there to provide that service. There is a, from the foundation's point of view, we need to balance what the industry needs for, to communicate to their customers and to their staff, and what they need in terms of the health and safety requirements, with what the destination challenges, if you like, what the programme needs. So we might need some very detailed research, but we need to be able to put that to the industry in a language which can be taken forward in that very practical day-to-day, what do I do this morning? And I think distilling that language is a challenge, and we need to balance this. We also need to provide stories that are meaningful for companies to communicate to staff and customers. So if we have some fantastic research that talks about poverty reduction and so on, unless we can actually explain that in a way that says, well, actually, if your customer wants to come to this destination, you know, if they provide, let's say they go and buy a tree in Sri Lanka, we've had a program where for some of the communities who were displaced during the tsunami, a program's been set up to allow customers travelling with their tour operator to buy a tree and give it to a family so that they've got a food or a medicine plant there to go into the garden where they were rehoused. And many of you will know that that the new housing tends not to have very much vegetation around. So it's distilling it down to that very practical and visual level. As I said in the earlier comment, there is a great willingness amongst the industry to get involved. But it's a very early stage, and I think the challenge there is for us to take hold of that willingness, if you like, and lead companies and show them how they can get involved, talking to their customers, involving their staff. And just one quick example. In Mexico, there's a program that we just got going, which is helping Mayan communities, which have not been benefiting from tourism, to use traditional recipes that they've had for making jam and supply that jam to major hotel chains in the tourist area. And in terms of scale, it's only at very early stages now, but if the pilot goes well, the scale and the opportunity for replication is absolutely enormous. And the great thing is that the communities can earn a living from that, earn money they were not earning previously, be able to stay in their homes, not have to commute to where the hotels are and live in the shanty towns, which is often the experience of communities in such places. And at the same time, the hotels get an exciting product to sell to their customers, part of making the customer experience a richer one. And then in between, the health and safety and all those sorts of requirements are sorted out by getting the hotels and the tour operator staff to participate in doing that evaluation. So the possibility is there, but we need to, I think we just need to seize that opportunity and distill that language there.
Great, thanks. Jane?
Yes, Jane Ashton. First Choice Holidays, just to give you First Choice in a nutshell, a leading international leisure travel company, operating out of 17 different source markets, 80 different brands, the largest of which is First Choice Holidays, which takes 2.5 million people away on holiday on its own airline out of the UK. The majority still to the East and West Med, but increasingly mid-haul destinations become more important, so Morocco, Tunisia, and long-haul Gambia, Kenya, Sri Lanka, Mexico, Donrep, Cuba. So all these destinations have significant poverty issues. From where I've been working, the major, or the first big challenge, I think, to mainstreaming pro-poor tourism is really convincing senior management of large companies that it is in their business interest to play a role in alleviating poverty. The environmental case has always been easier to make than the social case. And until the top level of management is really truly engaged in this, it's very difficult for those priorities to cascade down into the next layer of management and the people that can really make the difference at grassroots level on the ground. So your product managers and your purchasing managers and your area managers and your quality managers. So I think that's the primary challenge. having said that, once that's overcome, the next challenge is, well, what do you really do to make a difference? What are the most important things we can do to change operations? Our experience on that front probably falls into three main areas. Firstly, we've been working with the Cub Foundation since its inception on just about every overseas project, I think. And without going into the detail of the projects, I think some of the learnings we've had from that is that it's become very clear to the business that working on maximising the protocol benefits of tourism has great business value in terms of engaging and motivating staff, has great business value in terms of meeting customer requirements and enhancing customers' experience, as well as all the other reputational benefits, and not least of which is being able to actually bring significant benefits to the poor. So that's been a great process for getting involved on the ground. The second area, again, I won't elaborate because Chris has done so, but working with our industry peers and other NGOs on developing the Travel Life Guidelines and working with our suppliers on that. And we've trained about 90 of our quality coordinators who are now actively auditing our properties and working to support our properties to improve. Thirdly, another area which we are developing at First Choice is we're aware that the discretionary holiday spend of our customers and making sure that that reaches local communities is probably one of the areas where we've got the biggest opportunity to bring benefits to the poor. So an initiative that we've been working on with all our overseas staff this year is that every area manager has been tasked with working with the ground handlers to develop one new excursion which is particularly focused around maximising the benefits to the poor and to local communities. But are we doing the right thing? I mean, that's a challenge. We don't actually know yet. It's early days, and I would say that we haven't really got the metrics in place to measure whether these are the right things and to measure, start to monitor the performance. So that's an area to work on. One of the challenges related to that is the lack of really appropriate research that can help us, and to try and address that, we're looking to do two pieces of research between now and the end of the year, particularly on all-inclusives. All-inclusives are incredibly important for our business model and incredibly important for our customers. They're also quite a controversial area, and there's widely held opinions that they don't bring the maximum benefits to the communities that they could be. Again, there's research, there's GTZ's research, there's the Travel Foundation's research that slightly contradicts that. So we feel what we need to do is actually work with some of our biggest holiday villages, which are all inclusive properties, and to do some research to really track down how much of that tourism pound is staying in the local community. And a secondary piece of research, which is slightly different, would be doing some qualitative work with the communities around our holiday villages and understanding their needs better and working out how we can support them. Just one final challenge I've thrown to the pot. That's broadly where we're at with trying to mainstream pro-poor tourism. A big issue that's taxing us greatly is how do we tackle the dilemma of pro-poor tourism and pro-climate tourism. It's an irony that the people in poorest countries are those that are going to be most implicated by climate change, those that need the tourism most, and obviously getting the tourists there is contributing to climate change. So working really hard to try to reduce the carbon impact of our holiday taking, of our flying, is what we're working on very hard at First Choice at the moment.
Thank you very much, Jane. Just before we move on to Harold, it's just been quite fair to me that Neil and Amanda was also supposed to be on the panel. So after Harold, Neil, you've still got your slot. Harold.
Thanks. I wanted to start just by reflecting on what Simon said this morning. I mean, he did use the word celebration, and my mouth dropped open at that point. And I don't think it's been closed since, in the sense that I'm not sure that there is. Actually, there are some very good individual pieces of best practice to celebrate, but generally I don't think we should be too celebratory about what's happened. He also said that he thought there'd been a major change of direction since the 1970s. Again, I'm not convinced by that, Neil. Much of the work that's still being done on peripheral tourism, community-based tourism, ecotourism, is the same stuff the conservationists were doing in the 70s. Kate made the point that we don't have many examples where we can identify the impact of that work, and that's still true. 30 years on, we still don't have those examples. There's maybe two handfuls of cases around the world which have been written up. Whether that's because we've not had the funding or we've been too frightened to do it, others will have to answer, but we have not done it, and we now pay a price for that. And the price we pay is that we're now 9 years on since the first paper was written for DFID on peripheral tourism. It went through CSD 7 in 1999. We're 8 years on from there. And what do we have to show in terms of best practice? Actually, not very much. I think we need to be very careful, so long on, of being too self-congratulatory. And we need to see it as well in the context of the development agencies obviously about to abandon the Millennium Development Goals in some kind, in something called growth sharing, or share of growth. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I'm sure it's more dilute than what I thought we were working on. We've missed, I think, one important piece of practice. There's nobody here from the International Trade Centre, and they've done a lot of work linking tourism, the experience of talking with consumers, with craft exports. I think if we do this kind of thing again, we should certainly involve the International Trade Centre. But I was supposed to talk about mainstreaming. Let's just do that very quickly. Development agencies, I don't know of a development agency internationally which is mainstream tourism. DFID has its staff now pre-programmed to say, quote, we don't do tourism. It's in the first week induction training course. Governments, well, they remain interested still in the number of international arrivals. Even if average length of stay and spending is dropping, it doesn't matter, as long as more tourists arrive. Tax, I'm pessimistic. There's nothing to say that tax taken off tourists will be used for poverty alleviation. International governmental organisations are doing trust funds. They've not mainstreamed it at all. Banks, anybody who's ever worked for one of the banks knows that they give you these exciting terms of reference, but they make it very clear you'll only be paid if you come up with bankable projects. The loans need to be repaid. The banks haven't really changed their position very much. Universities, in case you think I'm not taking on everybody this afternoon. ODI, ourselves, everybody has failed to get tourism into the development studies agenda. It's not surprising, therefore, that those bright young things who go to work at DFID with their development studies degrees don't take tourism very seriously. We've consistently failed, at least in the UK, to deliver on that, which brings us to tourism businesses, which have actually done a great deal more, as far as I can tell. Not that I think they've done enough change, but they have nonetheless done a great deal more than many of the other groups in terms of making it mainstream. And I think you were right to pull out those two things. It's local sourcing, discretionary spending. And if we could achieve one thing today, it would be to move on from this sterile debate about all-inclusives or non-all-inclusives. That's not what matters. What matters is where the money is being spent and who's benefiting, whether that's through an all-inclusive or a non-all-inclusive. It doesn't seem to me to matter. We should be measuring the benefits which are going to poor people. And just the final point, really, to come back to what Kate was saying about the importance of targeting and convincing those. I mean, we all see the nice people from the banks at these events. We don't see the people who make the real decisions about the spending. And, you know, I've had that experience at the World Bank and at the IFC, and it's not a great experience because what they say is, well, where's the return on investment? And, Kate, they don't mean what you mean by return on investment. They mean, are we going to get our money back? Which is quite understandable. They're banks. We have to face, I think, the reality that unless we've got some measurable indicators, which frankly, 8 years on, we ought to have, and we don't have, I think we need to be a little more self-critical about our own practice over those 8 years.
Well said, Harold. Thank you. Oh, sorry. Harold always tells me that we don't agree, but I agree with every single word he says. So thank you very much, and you've taken a lot from my thing. But just to explain who I am, I'm Trisha Barnett. I work for an organisation called Tourism Concern. And for those of you who don't know Tourism Concern, we might well be the only campaigning organisation in the world campaigning internationally on the way tourism impacts on local people. So our remit is very much as an advocacy group, working on behalf of those people, and trying to get their voices out there to all those groups that Harold's just listed, every single one of them. That's our remit, that's what we've done. That's, you know, it's going to the Foreign Office, getting the Travel Foundation, doing all these things, you know, happening, getting people, not the Travel Foundation, but getting people to talk together, to understand what the issues are really, really important for us. And sometimes we definitely sort of like to antagonise people because we do it in a campaigning way. So we're campaigners, and we campaign for change because we are only too well aware that those impacts on the poor are pretty heavy. And what's missing from today is not just those lists that Harold's just said, but actually a much more important and vital list that I think is key to change. And Tourism Concern hopefully would agree with me. What we're looking at today is lots of micro stuff. We really are. We've got some fantastic projects. We've got one tour operator, one brilliant tour operator. She does not represent the whole of the British industry, which is being mainstreamed into pro-poor tourism. In fact, if you said the word pro-poor, they would probably freak out. You have to use a completely different language that's not a development language. What we've got and what is missing is the context of tourism in a globalised world. What we're missing from this debate, and who we're missing, are those people who set the agenda for trade. We all know it's an export industry, and we all know that GATS is fundamental to how industry is carried out, and liberalisation is key to it. And while there is a liberalised world, those people who are poor are going to suffer, because liberalisation in the developing world is not anything that those people who set the rules of trade, who dominate the rules of trade, are interested in. We have to do something about that. And if you want to understand GATS, I can't do that in 5 minutes, but it's pretty scary. It's scary stuff, and it actually means that every single poor country out there is open and is encouraged to bring in outside investment. And if you talk about the Gambia, when I first went to the Gambia, when a Gambian came to me and said, hey, we've got a problem, it's because he had to borrow money at 27%, and his little Kalodi tavern failed, and the tourism businesses were encouraged into the Gambia tax-free for 5 or 10 years. No, the tax doesn't go to the government. So when you go to the Gambia now, what do you find? As Jonathan did, a shoddy infrastructure. They've had tourism there for nearly 60 years. Researching why the poor are poor within a little narrow context is not going to be a solution. I encourage you, if you're going to do more research, and I really value what you've presented today, put it in that wider context. Work out why after 60 years in the Gambia, Jonathan is shocked because the electricity doesn't work full time, because there isn't a proper university, there's hardly a road, I don't know if they've yet put a boat on the river. It's scary. And if you go to other poor countries, I was invited into the Moroccan Tourist Board to talk about, hey, would you sign on to our code of good practice for the tourist? And I asked them what they're doing about tourism in Morocco. They tell me proudly that the World Bank is encouraging them. And the other missing ingredient today, the UNWTO. Where are they with their STEP program? Why haven't we mentioned them? What are we talking about? Where are they in Ethiopia? Hey, you try and look at their website and find out what they're actually doing. All this top-down, hey, we're here for the poor people stuff. You try and find out what's really, really going on. It's scary stuff. We do have to do that research. And thank you for opening all this up today.
So my background is actually from the industry. I operated in hotels in Kenya. And that's actually what started me down this road. That's where I first met Harold. And we operated there. We opened the first one. So I get it as such. But it did remarkably well. It sold incredibly well. We were able to get rid of the seasonality. We were able to employ more people, pay them better, all those things. And that's what really started me down this route. Of understanding that interplay. I then went over to the conservation world, because I was in the environment. And one of the big issues that I ran into in my work is that not every country has a first choice. Not every country has a big amount of outside investment. But they have a lot of poor people, I'm thinking about places like Madagascar, that have natural resources that need to be conserved in one way or another. There's a myriad of ways to do that. we've been through, how do you gauge tourism versus other economic options? But tourism is an option. It's an option that's exploding in that country right now. And we ran into a problem. CI, in many other countries, over history, has contributed to and built eco-lodges out in the middle of nowhere, and no baselines. We come back 5 or 10 years later and we say, that worked, let's write it up. That failed, let's not tell anybody about it. And walk away. And that has been the traditional history. There isn't a baseline to say, where's this going and how we can measure it. And Harold's absolutely right in pointing all of that out. Coming from the business side, that's a lot of what I'm trying to bring into the institution. The value chain is part of that. And creating a mechanism for people to share information across our entire internal system. And I was thrilled when Sean showed me some of the work he's doing, because if we are all going to be doing this, then it does start to create a body of information that we can start to use. One of the big problems we ran into was access to markets. We've talked about it. And we approached Responsible Travel, Justin, at the beginning of last year, to start on a trial basis. How can we deal with the challenge of these orphan projects, basically, the projects that have been set up in all these different parts of the world, whether by NGOs or by government agencies, in often remote places that didn't get a lot of tourists, and now even the communities have been suffering in many of these places. How do we help those where we believe they may be viable? How do we link them to tour operators who are looking for product in those areas? How do we start that dialogue? And basically, we created a web-based system, which this year will be more open. The first year is entirely on a trial basis. So Katie had the unfortunate task of manually reviewing all the entries, and then trying to match up which operators we were going to approach to talk about these new and different products. Premise being, it's of interest to the tour operators, it gives them an alternative, interesting product in their destination. The phase one, which is what we're doing right now, was 150 enterprises were invited globally. We only had 53 responses, so it's one third. 27 were accepted. So from a business standpoint, and that was, you just needed basic things like phone, email, faxes, the ability to respond to someone with flexible and reasonable accommodation, and some linkage to a national ground handler who a tour operator would be willing to work with. So a 20% success or response rate on what should have been a big database of tourism projects worldwide. I think Harold has information on this even further, even more details on this. Having said that, that information of those 27 was then sent out to 59 tour operators with holidays in the destinations that in which we had accepted these CBTs. And then in-person presentations, again on a trial basis, were done with people like Explore, with Exodus, there's a third one, Africa in Focus. And they're all very interested, and they want to pick them up for their coming year's brochures. Again, we've been very tight about this in the first year. We want to try to roll it out a lot more in the second year. But recognizing that these CBTs, in many cases, were developed without anyone even talking to a tour operator. So they are now coming in after the fact, after the money has been spent, and in building these things, and saying, yeah, we'd love to take this on, but why isn't the loo next to the sleeping accommodation? Where's the hand-washing facilities for the staff in the kitchens? Those basic issues were never taken seriously. They weren't involved in those conversations from the outset. And that's one of our really big lessons learned in terms of going forward. Bring them to the table in that development cycle on day one. Africa and Focus has picked up, Katie told me, Rungwe Tea in Rwanda. And that's one success we can definitely point to. We're waiting to hear from Exodus and Explore in terms of who they're going to put into their brochures for 08. that the goal for this year is to open it up to more countries, make it web-enabled so that the SMEs and community-based tourism operations can list themselves, and then work on an outreach strategy with the tour operators here in the US, and we'd love to get you on board to share what is out there so that we can try to integrate it into their supply chains in a very practical way. I think in closing, we really don't expect miracles out of this system. We were looking at that chain, we're looking for the missing links in that chain, and trying to determine how do you fill them, and trying on a totally experimental basis to find the solutions to it. At the ground end, we were responding to the need with regards to how do we get dollars, as you said, as I think you said at the beginning of your presentation, how do you get money into the hands of the people who are controlling the natural resources on which they depend, and that tourism depends. I mean, we're all a natural resource-based industry at the end of the day. And the poor get poorer in the needed environments. We've seen that time and time again. And at the other extreme, seeing this huge upsurge of tour operators here and in the US wanting to try to green themselves, but not wanting to contribute to the greenwash that takes place a lot, especially in other countries, it doesn't happen anymore. So, in closing, I was really pleased to hear that Michael Porter, the management consultant, the guru, who at one point said the responsibility of a company is to its shareholders, and that's it, said corporations are not responsible for all the world's problems, nor do they have the resources to solve them all. But a well-run company can have a greater impact on social good than any other institution or philanthropic organization. In that
I will be brief because there's wine in the kitchen and I'm sure you would like to drink something. But the issue is how to mainstream global tourism. And just to go back over the day, we had the indication how we got here. That was the history lesson, Caroline and David. We then talked about this pathways to prosperity, which is different ways that tourism can impact on the poor. We then had the case studies of how the poor can participate, and then straight after lunch, those examples of how that research can start to influence policy. Then we had the very illuminating panel discussion, and you know, I think it revealed some of the core issues coming out of the day. In terms of what we're going to do about this, I think there are, if I break it up into several groups. In terms of the industry, we know that there's differential performance in terms of pro-poor tourism. I think it's great that in that diversity there's some good practice that's coming out, and certainly commend work of the FPO as well as trying to spread that best practice over a broad range of operators, and the initiative with the Travel Foundation as well to start tackling these issues with the mainstream operators is great. And The indications that tour operators themselves are starting to worry about monitoring their own performance, I think, is a really welcome sign. In terms of researchers and academics, we got it in the eye, didn't we? I mean, clearly we haven't done anything for the last 9 years, but I think we've got a very extensive list of things to do in our dressing down. We're going to develop rigorous methodologies. We're going to start benchmarking whilst recognising the specifics of different destinations. We're going to develop a framework or a start agreeing on what definitions we're going to apply, and we're going to pilot that in a range of locations. So I think the real pressure on us, though, as researchers, is that the world is changing and there's a possibility that someone's going to listen to us. And we've got to have something to say that's coherent. And this is a very unusual experience, I think, for most researchers. And I think we feel that responsibility, the weight of it, quite heavily. We also had, I think, some very pertinent gaps in what we're doing highlighted. The whole climate change thing, which, you know, we're kind of passing around like a hot cake. I think we're going to have to deal with tourism and climate change very seriously. I think the whole liberalisation and GATS debate and tourism and globalisation has to be dealt with. I think that the role of the development agencies also is an extremely important one. I mean, what we're hearing, I mean, we're hearing from the real pioneers within development agencies. It's not representing the whole organisation. But the point is that some people are now changing, and we need to build on that. Finally, what I'd like to say is that I think there is a window of opportunity. I think that lots of things are changing. I mean, the most important one is that as people, our attitudes are changing. That's what's driving what tour operators are doing, and it's going to drive what we as industry, as researchers, as donors would do. I think that the pressure is on us to have a more developmental approach, and I think that there's a coalition of unusual bedfellows building up with some non-governmental organisations, a couple of development agencies. I mean, you've got people like DCZ who have been doing this for years and years, but they're really unusual. And clearly we are getting some more interest from untraditional donors. We've got some tour operators who are beginning to be expressing interest. And also some research organisations that have spent a bit of time thinking how we're going to do this from our different vantage points. The responsibility I think we have within the room is to use that window of opportunity. Because we could sit around and whinge that everyone in the World Bank is going to be in tourism, or all the analysis is tourism is not of kind of blue chip quality. But I think this South Africanism of an emerging consensus that got then to democracy is a pretty good way to go. And I think there is a turning point where you decide that you're going to go with something, even if everyone doesn't agree with you, because enough people do. And I was very interested, Chris, last week in Turkey, the comment from one hotel owner. We did these big workshops with hundreds of people, and we did an evaluation at the end of it, which instead we were also asking you to do, so that we perform better next time. And the comment that came back from this hotel owner, who spent a day going through a whole environmental and social and economic audit about how you could improve your performance, was, "I am not alone." It's the same for the first time that the things that he was feeling about wanting to be more sustainable, wanting to link up with the local economy to create a bigger impact, he suddenly realised that other people were thinking the same thing. And I think within the travel industry, that's what we've got to work on. That individually, lots of people have been thinking, "I wish I could do this," and, you know, being given 10 very good reasons why they don't. But actually, if we can link up, I think that there will be enough of institutional effort to actually do the things that we've been talking about so long.